Hello, everyone. Welcome to the world's most fantastic podcast. That's right. It's Uncanny Treks does the Jonathan Hickman run on Fantastic Four. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Tonight, we are talking about FF Volume 1, which is to say Future Foundation numbers 12 through 16. It's Volume 3 of FF by John Hickman. Although if you're counting in terms of the overall numbers, you'd probably say it was Volume 5.5. All Hope Lies in Doom, issues number 12 through 16. Matt, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing all right. Guys, good luck keeping up with the chronology piece with this as far as the numbers go. I'm lost. I don't care, though, because that's a good story. And on top of that, this ties in with what we already covered. It almost runs congruent to the other part.
If you were going to read these, you would read one issue of Fantastic Four, one issue of FF, and alternate back and forth. And it does that pretty cleanly. I think you can definitely read the Fantastic Four comic, which we talked about last time, without this. There's a few things that are skipped over, but you don't really notice it. But it would be a lot more difficult to read Future Foundation or FF without reading the main Fantastic Four comic. Would you agree with that, Matt?
Oh, I agree 100%. Yes, for sure. This has more, this adds value to what you've already read.
And it's interesting because in some sense you could read it without seeing what Reed, Sue, Ben, and Johnny are up to, because it is mostly just the perspective of the FF kids. But yeah, you would still be a little mystified by some of the plot developments. All right, so our artist for numbers 12 through 14 is an Argentinian artist named Juan Bobbio. He's probably most known for also working on Dan Slott's She-Hulk run, which was back in the day, a little before this. And then we have Nick Dragata come on for numbers 15 and 16. We saw some of his work before, and he goes on to collaborate with Hickman on East of West, the Image comic, which I really like, but since I saw Matt had it on his want to read on Goodreads, I'm just going to warn him that I didn't find the ending very satisfying.
The artist for these first couple of issues, it's not my favorite style. All the characters look a little uglier than I'm used to.
You do like Dragata's, though, right?
I like Dragata's.
Yeah. First issue, Matt, is number 12, Too Many Kids, a very self-referential title, potentially. Do you want to walk us through the plot of Too Many Kids?
Yeah, so the FF kids escape from the climactic battle in Fantastic Four number 600 to Castle Doom, where they ally with Collard Doom, Christoph, Doombots, Nathaniel, and Evil Reed to access R. Reed's multiversal bridge.
We see that Dragon Man is still rocking his pacifism. He's got the pretty pithy saying, I think, the best conflict is one avoided.
I agree. Yeah, but someone's definitely going to reprogram him one day to be violent, and that's going to be awesome. So look forward to whatever that happens.
I can't remember if this concern was coming more from Bentley or more from Franklin, but Matt, do you think Dr. Doom has snacks?
I'm pretty sure he does, Bob, because was there not a Hostess Pie ad with the Fantastic Four and Dr. Doom back in the 70s? We had a couple of 70s comics that had those ads in them, and I remember one with Dr. Doom.
I remember the Hostess ads. I don't remember one with Doom, but it's entirely possible that there was one with Doom. And I think in the comics, Doom sort of famously sets a good table. Most recently that I remember, in Jerry Duggan's X-Men, he hosts Miss Marvel, Wolverine, and a couple of other X-Men. And he's got one of the best halal chefs in the world to cook for Miss Marvel.
Yeah, he's got a good selection, Bob. He knows how to entertain guests. He's got food in the pantry. Not really a bad guy. I mean, I'm starting to like Dr. Doom.
He's one of my favorite anti-heroes, Matt. Yeah, one of my favorite anti-heroes. Another example that comes to mind is also a Jerry Duggan comic, so maybe this is just a Jerry Duggan thing, but I don't think it's just him. It's Savage Avengers, which is to say the Conan in the Marvel Universe book, and at one point in that run, Doom hosts Conan at his table.
Oh, nice. You can get a Savage to come and sit at your table. Must have some good scruples going on there. That's nice.
Yeah. I would say Conan's manners are even worse than Wolverine's or Lobo's or Ben Grimm's.
But Dr. Doom, he was able to tame that and have Conan at the dinner table.
I do like the visual contrast we get in this issue. If you have Christoph in Doom's usual green cloak, and then you have Doom himself in the Future Foundation white, I thought that was a nice visual contrast.
Yeah, I love the Doom in the white. I still like it. Every time I see it, I still think it's one of the better looks for Doom.
Yeah. And I also think it's convenient that Bentley has the old Atlantean fish people there, that he can threaten to eat them, because if they weren't there, he would just threaten to eat Franklin.
Wouldn't you eat your pet to survive, Bob?
Let's see. I don't think the Atlanteans are pets, Matt. B, I don't really like fish, so that would be gross. And C, no, I wouldn't eat my Dixie cat. I would let my cat eat me instead of eating her.
I think the problem here is the FF doesn't have any pets. That's what it's missing.
I mean, maybe they need to put Herbie more in the book. Instead of just having him be Val's security system, they need him to be a Star Wars droid rolling around.
If the Moloids aren't pets and the fish head Atlanteans aren't pets, Bob, we they need a dog. Dragon Man's not a pet. They need some pets, and that would even this out. I'd be good with it.
Speaking of amusements for children, Matt, should Val get her lightsaber, or should she give it to Bentley?
Yeah, this issue, Val just decides to build a lightsaber. That came out of nowhere. But I think she should keep it, because she needs something cool to balance out Franklin's godlike powers. Franklin's got the cool godlike powers. Val has a lightsaber. It's pretty even.
And I think we need to contextualize this. This was, even though Star Wars was everywhere, even then, this was pre-Disney merger. So Disney didn't own both the FF and Star Wars at that time. And you didn't have the new movies. You didn't have all the Disney TV shows. So Star Wars wasn't as oversaturated then as it is now, even though it was still very prevalent.
Yeah, because now we can literally have CGI Luke Skywalker hand Val a lightsaber if we needed to.
Yeah, oh God, I didn't consider, but you're absolutely right. That's, God.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can keep podcasting that. You just totally deflated me with that observation.
House of Mouse, folks. They're working on it right now.
I Matt, do you want to say something about Nathaniel time traveling? I don't have
So, energy. Bob, so Nathaniel's very cavalier in his approach to time travel, Bob. And I don't think he's watched enough Back to the Future, because if he keeps messing with things he is and giving away these hints about what's to happen, he's just going to destroy the entire space-time continuum. I mean, he's already treated like toilet paper up to this point, so...
Look, Matt, if the trajectory of our space-time continuum is hurtling towards Luke Skywalker handing Valeria a lightsaber, what's the problem with messing with it? That's what I say.
Well, this is the thing, too, with Hickman. Jonathan Hickman... He doesn't have an issue with just tearing apart the entire reality of things and bringing it back together. He does the same thing with X-Men and Mr. Sinister and the whole Myra piece. He has no issue just resetting continuity whenever he feels or redoing something to fit whatever he needs in the story.
Well, yes and no, right? Because it's funny because the resets with Moira and Sinister are pretty radical, but they're also really, really contained. I remember when people were first reading House of X, the question was, oh, does this mean different X-Men stories took place in different timelines? And it's, nah, it just means that all of the ones we've read take place in this Moira's life, right?
Right. But he does, I mean, I'm just saying though, he does like to tear away at the fabric of reality all the damn time. Yeah. He has no issue doing that.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
You have to have a broad understanding of what he's doing to get any idea of where he's going with these stories. Because these are not linear in any way. There's nothing linear about his stories.
We talked about how, I think for Image, he did 5 miniseries before he started doing ongoings for Image and ongoings at Marvel. If I'm remembering correctly, 2 of the 5 deal with time travel. One is Pax Romana, which I like a lot, and deals with time travel in a pretty simple way, if I'm remembering correctly, although bear in mind it's been 10 years since I've read it. Apparently that was supposed to be a sci-fi network show at some point, but that never came to pass. But then he also has one that's called Red Wing that I didn't remember liking as much, but I think it might do more complicated stuff with time travel. I'm curious if you were to read the Red Wing series, what you would think of it.
Okay. That could be good.
Yeah, because it's just a mini-series.
No. All right, Bob, move on to issue number 13.
What's going on in number 13, The Bridge, Matt?
So, to her grandfather's consternation, Valeria has stolen my favorite MacGuffin, the ultimate nullifier, to extort Evil Reed into doing what no multiversal Reed has ever done, Free a Doom.
I was really hoping I would get you to refer to yourself in the third person with that.
Yeah, you were. And I was able to quickly just boom.
You were too smart for me. You just pivoted like a Judo master.
So smart, just so witty.
Leech tells Franklin and Franklin's about to face down a Celestial. Leech has great advice, Matt. It just boils down to this. Get good.
Yeah, Franklin plays life like a video game with cheat codes, Bob. But it's not just regular cheat codes. He's got a game genie in a pocket universe.
It's saying that Franklin has to get good is maybe a little bit of an exaggeration. Yeah, right?
He's going to have some massive cheat codes to get to beat the Celestials.
I will say at the end of this episode, Matt, that the Doom and Val scene, which we're going to revisit a couple more times, makes me very happy. I love Doom and Val scenes so much.
Yeah, my niece recently made it into this world, Bob, and I want our relationship to be like that between Val and Doom. Hopefully I don't regret those words by the end of this whole podcast or whatever we're doing with this.
I don't think you'll regret it. Okay. Maybe there's something I'm forgetting, but I don't think you'll regret it. All right, Matt. So moving on to number 14, it's 27 minutes. What's the plot of 27 minutes?
So Nathaniel, Valeria, Evil Reed, and Doom play for enough time to stop the Celestials in the main Fantastic Four book.
So Matt, were you happy to, we haven't really had the Hickman scripts or visual inserts or graphs that we would expect, but we do have Valeria plotting out her plan to stop the Celestials on an x-axis. Did that make you happy?
Yes, Bob, that's how time works. It's a linear, a straight line that can be diverted based on actions, right? That's how time works.
I mean, isn't it pretty to think so, Matt?
Yeah. I just want to say this, Bob. Every time I see Alex Powers, I have to remind myself of who he is and why he's here.
I think it's just power.
He seems a tacked-on character right now. I'm hoping they go deeper with him a little more.
I think he's supposed to be the babysitter, right? Which doesn't necessarily lend itself to great depth. And I mean, if there is a problem with the Hickman run, you may not agree with this, but I would say probably the problem is that apart from Frank and Val, the FF kids just are not developed at all. And Bentley, too. Bentley's developed. But apart from those three, the others just aren't developed, which is one reason I want us to go ahead and just read the Matt Fraction Future Foundation comic right after this, because Fraction actually does some differentiating between the kids, if that makes sense.
That would probably help, because I get a lot of them confused, and it just there's so many. Although they do come to a solution to this later on. We'll talk about that when we finish up this episode.
Well, and then you had a really good point about Nathaniel's catastrophe theory.
Yeah, Nathaniel's catastrophe theory really explains all of Hickman's story structure. And I just found it very relevant to everything that Hickman's done so far with Fantastic Four. Nathaniel describes it as a series of ever-worsening, ruinous events that individually represent a system-wide threat, but when combined, constitute the permanent obliteration of said system. The system, in this case, is all mankind. And I'm just, that's what Jonathan Hickman did last time at Fantastic Four. We had how many different threats coming at the Fantastic Four at the same time?
You say it's very apt to describe how he approaches his Avengers run and his X-Men run as well.
Yeah, they'll just throw every possible threat at them, and then it will somehow dissolve.
The interesting thing is that I think, based on interviews I heard a long time ago with Hickman, I think he had no affection for Fantastic Four or for Avengers at all before he wrote them. It sounds like when he was growing up, he was an X-Men kid, and then he also liked DC.
Oh.
And so I think in some ways it's him applying the universe of the perpetual DC crossovers that are more universe shaking, or the X-Men constant alternate realities, constantly averting the future, him applying it to the mainstream Marvel books, which I think is interesting.
Bob, on a much lighter note here, we do see one of the Celestials finger blast a portal.
Always good to see a finger blast, Matt. Always good. And then, speaking of finger blasting, Matt, were you happy to see Evil Reed use the ultimate nullifier on a Celestial?
I was disappointed. I expected more. It was a dud, Bob. Sorry. It just didn't look... I wanted something cooler looking.
This is maybe a problem you run into with the Marvel Cosmic stuff. It's not just a Hickman thing. You see it in Jack Kirby and Jim Starlin. You build up these things, the Celestials or the Ultimate Nullifier, so much. But then, even though in some sense you can represent anything on a page, you still have to represent them on a page.
Yeah.
And there's just only so much you can do to capture the grandeur, right? I was thinking, in the last episode when we were thinking about the brawl of the Galactus and the Celestials, it's a very cool scene. But it's also just a brawl between big dudes. There's not that much else to it. But you have Sue Storm saying, oh, it's just too big, implying this Lovecraftian idea. Yeah. The scale is out of whack. And it is an interesting tension that all the Marvel Cosmic comics have to balance. Of, on the one hand, you want this to be mind-blowing, universe-shaking stuff. On the other hand, it's always just going to be an action figure drawing.
Yeah, and then you see the Ultimate Nullifier in all its glory, and it just looks like a laser gun.
I did really love, though, after this, you have, in a flashback, you have a different multiversal Reed describing the Nullifier and saying, quote, to use it is to die, such a forbidden and alluring thing. I actually did think that was a really cool line.
That is a good line.
All right, Matt. So number 15 is the one where the Power Pack shows up. So what happens in the one with where the Power Pack shows up?
Oh, yes, the Power Pack's going to show up, but the eponymous Power Pack show up to give the future Foundation kids a ride to the hub, which, because Hickman uses every part of the War of the Four Cities, is guarded by evolved Moloids.
So earlier in this episode, in this issue, we see the Moloids arm the floating head, whose name is Tong, and one of them says, have gun, we'll hover, which is a pun on a Western TV show. It cracked me up. And then Matt, Katie Power, most famous for hanging out with a mostly naked Wolverine as Lady Shiva and the Reavers are stalking him. Did you like her decking Bentley for being such a creep?
Yeah. Any guess what he said, Bob?
I have to imagine that he promised her eternal satanic delights. That's what I like to imagine.
Yeah. Bentley's a cool kid, Bob.
Bentley's great, but he probably deserved to get punched. And even if he didn't, I'm glad Katie did it.
Yeah, me too.
So did you find Franklin breaking the fourth wall and talking to the white silhouette of his future self a little creepy? I found it a little creepy.
I'll say it's better than a hologram from the future or just him just listening to recording or some device. So it's okay for what it is.
Well, and it creates some suspense, I think. Maybe you disagree, but it makes you feel, oh, maybe future Franklin and future Val are playing some other different game, right?
Right.
Maybe they're not as altruistic as they say. Or maybe it's also just a way to say that with someone, you were saying, with Franklin's game genie godlike powers, that's just a really unsettling idea, even if it is the person who has them is the best person in the world, right?
Right, yeah. That's just a lot of power. I don't even know. We don't know the limits of his powers at this point. Apparently, he can do whatever he wants.
I think it's pretty established from earlier FF writers, not just Hickman, that there aren't really limits on Frank's powers. He's creating universes.
Yeah, it's insane.
One other quick thing I wanted to say was that I like that Hickman. You could easily read Hickman as an annoying science bro. But the fact that towards the end of 15, you have the Moloid kids preaching to the now unevolved Moloids that they have to learn, that so it's education over evolution is the theory. That's what I think really makes Hickman different from your IDW creeps and your really weird right-wing science types who've risen in the past 10 years is this focus on education over evolution.
Yeah, Bob, you took my favorite dialogue from it, Bob. That was my favorite.
Oh, It's okay, Bob.
But the whole line is, it's education, not evolution, that will save you. We will teach you words and how to use a fork. The time has come. No more pooping on the floor. Come with us. Learn about the miracles of indoor plumbing. That is from the Moloids themselves. That's from the educated Moloids to the uneducated Moloids.
Look how you've been educated, because you were just calling them pets, and now you've been educated into giving them the dialogue of the week.
Right, now I know the fish people are the pets. So.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I messed that up. All right, Matt. I'm sorry I stepped on your favorite dialogue line.
Okay, moving on
to number 16, One Step Beyond. What's the plot for that?
Valeria broods about her grounding during battle cleanup and Reed showing the kids the new improved Future Foundation headquarters.
We have future Franklin revealing to our Franklin that beards don't itch, which they really don't. And he confirms that he trained Galactus to fulfill this shared dream they've long had.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about the buddy-buddy Galactus and future Franklin. I don't know. I'm not sure on it, Bob. I'm not sold on it just yet.
I thought it was sweet. There was like emotional resonance to their conversation that happens after future Franklin's conversation with our Franklin. And since Galactus is a sentient being, even though he is responsible for untold death and carnage, he is a sentient being, and seeing him in a pet position or an enslaved position is a little uncomfortable. And so seeing that there is this bond between Franklin and his herald, I thought was nice.
Bob, maybe they should start a podcast together.
Galactus would be a good podcaster. I don't think Franklin would be a good podcaster. Because he has the godlike powers, I think he doesn't have enough frustration and internalized self-loathing, which, as we all know, is the only place from which good podcasting can come from.
Exactly, Bob. I don't know if they'd be able to just get together on a regular basis with all the crazy going on. Be very infrequent.
Well, maybe they're together on what used to be Galactus's ship is now Franklin's ship. They're traveling the universe. Might be a lot of downtime to podcast, but I just don't. You know, Galactus would be good at it, but Franklin wouldn't be. That's my take.
Who's not good at stuff, Bob? Red Hulk. I don't like Red Hulk.
Yeah. I don't like Red Hulk either, but I will say I would read a comic where Valeria and Red Hulk team up. That's the only Red Hulk comic I can ever imagine wanting to read.
That would be a really... I don't think that would be a very good comic, but you give it a shot.
Well, think about it. What if we had a Valeria team-up comic and one issue was Red Hulk?
Oh, okay. I could do that. If they just had a Valeria team-up book, I could dig that. Like what they did with Deadpool, how Deadpool destroyed the Marvel Universe. Let's have Valeria teams up with the Marvel Universe.
It's the new version of Marvel team-up, but with Valeria instead of Spider-Man.
Yeah, I love it.
I also do like the idea that all the FF has to do for battles now is they shift the debris from their battles into the negative zone, and then the bugs in the negative zone can harvest the debris. I think that's a very interesting, sustainable model.
Well, yeah, I mean, the negative zone is essentially a landfill in that way. I wonder if there's stuff that the bugs can't digest.
That would be a good future Fantastic Four comic. Like,
what do we find? All the plastic they've been sending over there cannot be decomposed by the bug people.
And what if there's a major
problem in the negative zone?
What if the Fantastic Four become the villains in a Captain Planet episode, and they have to fight a bug negative zone version of Captain Planet? I was hoping you'd be more excited for that, but apparently you're not.
I'm okay with it. I'm just trying to think of how that would work. Do Captain Planet's powers work in the negative zone?
And is it's not Captain Planet. It's a negative zone equivalent of Captain Planet.
Oh, all the pollution and nastiness in the negative zone creates its own villain. In a sense, well, really, it's the negative zone's hero, but it's the villain to the Fantastic Four.
Yes, yes.
I just want to see Reed Richards with some plastic bag picking up bottles. That's how it ends. Together, we can do this. We can solve the problems of the future. The FF kids picking up bottles by a lake. It's beautiful. Great ending.
This is getting messed up, but now I'm having visions, Cool Hand Luke style, of the FF bringing in all their bad guys from Earth to work the chain gang and pick up the litter, and Reed Richards is hanging out with a shotgun. What we have here is a failure to communicate, son.
We'll see. On the other worlds, they have the Hall of Dooms, or the Hole of Dooms, or whatever we call it. They're the ones that pick up all the trash.
No, they're just in a hole, Matt. They don't pick up trash. How can they pick up trash? They're in a hole. They can put trash in the hole with the Dooms, but they're just in a hole.
Well, we learn later. Eventually, we learn about this Parliament of Dooms coming up soon. Indeed. So maybe the Parliament of Dooms could also collect trash.
Somebody's been reading ahead.
I haven't been reading ahead. It happens at the end of this issue. That's what they call it, Parliament of Doom. I'm assuming that's what it is.
It is. Yeah, you're right. I guess we would say Council of Doom. Or do they call it Parliament?
I think it's Parliament. It said at the end of this issue.
Okay. That's, Doom always has to be grander than Reed, so Reed can have a council, but Doom has to have a parliament. I will say I do love the splash page where the FF, Nathaniel, and Spider-Man are all ready to scold Val, and the splash page is mostly from Val's perspective. She's in the foreground looking at them. It's very funny.
Crazy Val, always causing the problems, but then always solving them. All right. So,
well, Matt, speaking of problems and solutions.
Yeah, Bob, here's a very big problem I've had. I can't keep up with who these damn kids are, because to me, they all look the same. So,
aren't you a school teacher, Matt? Shouldn't you be able to tell kids apart?
Yeah, not when they all wear the same outfits.
This is Matt's argument against school uniforms.
And not when they're all white.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, Bob, they decide they're going to put numbers on the costumes. And this just lets me know which little white boy I'm looking at, which I appreciate. I now know that 5 is 5 and 6 are Val and Franklin, and 13 is Bentley, which was meant to be ironic. And then the power dude, Alex Power, is some random ass number. Which one is he?
I don't remember.
Well, see, this is why Alex Power needs to go away, because no one cares and no one remembers.
Ouch. But he can bring in his cooler siblings like Katie to save the day.
Oh yeah, Katie Power's way cooler. Love me some Katie Power.
She punched Bentley, and she hung out with a nearly naked Wolverine in the snow as the Reavers tried to kill him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the gifts, Bob. Let's talk about the gifts.
Yeah. Oh, man. I do love Val giving a gift to her Uncle Doom. And then we have the gag or the motif, right, of we show their conversation three times over. It's a neat little effect of we see more and more of what the conversation was.
Three times is very artistic. Four times is a drag. Two times.
Also, speaking of Val's relation with her other uncle, her Uncle Johnny, I really do love Johnny starting to go off about his thing for bad girls while scolding Val and Spider-Man having to shut him down. That was very funny. So, Matt, what was your favorite visual of this issue?
There's a very
series of issues.
Yeah, there's a very sweet visual of Franklin hugging Leech in issue 15. Just before Franklin's staying behind to do some things or whatever to use his powers to fight the Celestials.
Is that right after Leech told him to get good, nerd?
It's nice. A nice scene. I thought it was very... The other visual is in issue 14 where the alternate Reed Richards gets blown to hell. So.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about a different image from...
Oh, no.
Look, folks, there's only so many ways to draw a portal.
Yeah. And when
there's
you
only
get,
so many ways.
And when a Celestial wants to come through a portal, they can either go... head first or feet first, but the way it's drawn makes it look like the Celestial decided to go dick first. So give yourself a look on that page.
It's a foot, but it sure do look like a dick.
Yep. Issue 14, Celestial dick right there in front of everybody. And they got two.
Huh, we're getting into Klingon territory here. I will say I had a different favorite visual, but I don't really want to bring my favorite visual up after your favorite visual here. So my favorite visual is now your favorite visual. We'll just say there's only so many ways you can draw a hole. And if you're curious what we're talking about, go reread issue number 14 with that in mind. Matt, what's your favorite dialogue from these issues?
So, Bob, my favorite dialogue is I've already said it, Bob, because you ruined it by making it something that you wanted to
but
share.
But I want you to remind the listeners, Matt. I want you to remind the listeners.
So, Bob, it's education, not evolution, that will save you. We will teach you words and how to use a fork. The time has come. No more pooping on the floor. Come with us. Learn about the miracles of indoor plumbing. That would be the smart moloids.
The smart moloids. My favorite dialogue is also from issue number 14, where Val says, I've made everything seem like a fair trade. She's saying this to her Uncle Doom. But I knew all along it led to this. You, Doom, buying us time. You sacrificing yourself. I'm sorry, Uncle Doom. I've been a very bad girl. To which Doom just replies, some of us like you that way.
Oh,
very sweet. Right. So no contest, right, Matt? Our favorite character this time, no contest.
This is Valeria, Bob. Just best character. Franklin's too godlike. It's hard to like Franklin because he's OP. I can't.
Yeah, I would like Franklin a lot if he wasn't godlike. But when he's godlike, his every guy personality is charming, but just not when he's in god mode.
All right, Bob, my favorite issue was issue number 14.
Where, and we already said why, Matt.
Yeah, it's got to be that Celestial dick. That's why I like that issue. Not that it's actually a really good issue in a sense. Worth a read.
It is. The whole thing. Yeah, definitely. I'll go with number 16, but I see your draw to 14. So next time, Matt, we are covering the main book, the last portion of Hickman's run on the main Fantastic Four book. That would be Fantastic Four Volume 6 if you're reading the original trades. In terms of issue numbers, it's issue number 605 through 611, but there's also a .1 issue, so it's 605, 605.1, and then 606 through 611.
Yeah, did you get that, guys? It's very hard to understand the chronology of these books, but it's all good, though. Just stick with it.
I could say it in an easier way if I said 605.1 and 605 through 611, but you need to read 605 before you read 605.1.
Also, I feel they collected all these books in a pretty large trade or omnibus or something.
Yeah, I think it's three or four overall trades, but I'm not sure if they did. I assume they probably did, but I don't know if in those newer, bigger trades, if they alternate Fantastic Four to FF.
Okay.
They probably do, but I don't know that for sure. But the original collection was Fantastic Four and FF are split. And we said probably not the best reading experience for FF, but it's a fine reading experience for Fantastic Four.
Yeah. Well,
all right, Matt. Well, we're almost there. We're in, we're inside of the end. There's only two more episodes we have on the Hickman run, although then I'm going to hit you with three more Future Foundation episodes just because now's the time to do it since we're fresh on the Future Foundation. But
and you said those are by Matt Fraction, right? Matt Fraction?
The first two are by Matt Fraction, okay. Although Fraction does leave in the middle of the second one and he get other people take over. And then the third one is just a short little miniseries by Jeremy Whitley. It came out maybe 2021, whereas the Fraction ones are from right after. Hickman's wrapping up. Avengers versus X-Men is happening as the big crossover. And then it's Marvel Now, and Matt Fraction is on Fantastic Four and FF for Marvel Now. But his Fantastic Four comic is not that great. It's not terrible, but it's not that great. And it also separates Fantastic Four and Future Foundation, so you just need to read the Future Foundation.
Okay. Yeah, I love me some Matt Fraction and Iron Man and Hawkeye. Yeah, that was some good stuff.
Yeah, I gotta confess, I don't like his Iron Man.
Oh, I enjoy really the Iron Man. I have fond memories of it, strangely.
It's just hard for me. I only read it a few years ago. It would have been better if I had been reading it at the time. And I also just don't like Tony Stark. I don't like reading Tony Stark comics. I've tried. I just don't care.
So, okay, this is a random question, but when you read a comic with Tony Stark, do you imagine Robert Downey Jr.?
Yeah, I pretty much do. And I do too. I don't mind Tony Stark in an Avengers comic. It's fine to have him as part of the ensemble, but I just can't take a whole series focused on him. It's just, he's not that interesting a character to me.
Robert Downey Jr. is Iron Man in my head. And I can't, anytime I see it, him not as Iron Man and I'm reading a comic, it doesn't look enough like him. It throws me off completely. It's a weird feeling.
Well, I mean, a weird sensation. I don't like the MCU, but I mean, you do have to give it to the MCU. Pretty much all the Avengers, with the exception of Hawkeye, that's who I think about when I read it.
Right. Yes. It's so strange, but it's. I don't know. Do you think this is a unique? What would you even call this? A unique perspective that only we're able to have now because we've had so many. Because I'm thinking of in the past, you've had different versions of stories and such, but never to this extent. Of having a film version with so many different versions and then a comic book version with a character with over almost 100 years of story. It's crazy.
I would disagree because I feel like when I was a kid, I thought of Adam West and then Kevin Conroy as Batman.
Okay. See, I've always seen Keaton in my head. Actually, no, I take that back. When I see Bruce Wayne, I see the Bruce Wayne from Nightfall. That's always the image in my head. If I think of Bruce Wayne, that's the one that pops in my face. I guess because I just read those so many times.
Yeah, with the scruffy 5 o'clock shadow.
Yes, and that's the face I see. When I think of a Bruce Wayne real actor, I think of Michael Keaton. Still, I never thought much of Affleck, even though he was a good Batman in my opinion. He wasn't bad. It just never really stuck. I don't know. Maybe that's just because those were during my formative years. Who Batman was.
At first, and you went a different direction with this, but at first I thought you were saying the unique thing was that we had the interesting thing of we'd read not a whole lot, but we definitely read some Fantastic Four and Avengers comics before the MCU. Mm-hmm. And so having the experience of being able to remember Avengers before the MCUification and then Avengers after the MCUification, I think is an interesting place to be.
It really is because I'm thinking, yeah, and that is part of Bob's the characterization piece. There, I feel like the characterization of what I guess Tony Stark was before I saw Robert Downey Jr. is completely different. I mean, he was still a rich dude, but he was.
Was it? I mean, maybe Downey Jr. made him a little more flippant, but did it change it?
Not a ton, but enough to where I just feel
okay.
It's a separate, it's almost a separate piece. Like that's who I see as Tony Stark now. But there are characters that can you think of a character though, other than Hawkeye, that you still, when you think of them, you think of the comic book counterpart, never of like a TV or movie version.
I either don't think of the the film and TV versions of Superman at all, or if I do, I think of either Dean Cain or the Tim Daly who voices the animated Superman.
Yeah.
So that, but I don't feel even those have that much influence on how I see Superman.
See, Superman to me is always Christopher Reeve in my head. I have to alter my head.
You didn't
grow up with those. Yeah, you didn't grow up with it. Yeah. And then the other thing too, Daredevil though. Daredevil's one. I only picture the comic book Daredevil, even though we've had two different screen adaptations. I don't ever even think of Daredevil as Ben Affleck's version, or I can't get the guy's name.
The one I watched Marvel. The first two seasons, and I think that Irish guy, Charlie Cox. I thought Charlie Cox was a pretty good Daredevil, but I guess...
Oh, he was great. I just always picture in my head Daredevil from the comics because it being the better representation.
Part of that is I read a lot of Daredevil comics before the Daredevil show, and I have not read a lot since the Daredevil show. There's no causal thing. That's just how it's shaken out. Yeah.
But then X-Men for me, go-to in my brain is always going straight to X-Men 92. Not because we do the podcast, but it's always been that way. I'm always picturing Wolverine in the yellow and blue, Jean Grey in the orange and all that, Cyclops with the whole visor piece with the hair coming out.
But for me, that doesn't happen as much because the Morrison stuff, which I read not too long after it came out, that just broke the connection for me in a way.
See, I think that's what I think. As I continue to read more, maybe I'll start to destroy some of these weird. I guess is it typecasting or stereotypes I'm using? What would you call this?
I don't know. I don't think that's. I don't think either of the. I'm not sure what the right. There probably is a term for it, and I don't know. But I think what you're describing is a normal thing that people do. I think I do it a little less than other people do it, just on average. So that also might be why something like the Morrison run can just sever X-Men from the cartoon in my mind. Well, very interesting to talk the Hickman Fantastic Four run with you. Maybe even more interesting to talk about our abnormal psychologies with you, Matt.
This is what Hickman does to us, Bob, with his X-Men, and he makes us think his X-Men and Fantastic Four.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening to All Hope Lies in Doom. Join us next time for one more time, Fantastic Four, 605, 605.1, and 606 through 611. I am Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening.